Welcome back to the West Wing Weekly. I'm Joshua Molina.
And I'm Hrishikesh Hirway. Today we're talking about Running Mates. It's episode 10 from season 7.
This episode was written by Peter Noah. It was directed by Paul McCrane. What jumps to mind when you hear the name Paul McCrane?
I don't know.
Fair enough. I'm just old. For me, it's Fame. 1980s breakout film, Fame. He played Montgomery.
I know the song from Fame.
Oh, sure. The one that goes, Fame!
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He sang multiple songs in Fame, and I think composed one of the songs that he performed.
No kidding.
But very good actor, would become famous on ER. He has a long list of credits, but I remember being very excited to be directed by Paul because he played Montgomery in Fame.
Did you talk about it?
Probably not. I'm a little shy. Paul is a great guy. Terrific actor, terrific director, and a lot of fun. Great sense of humor. I like him very much.
And he directed this episode, which is about the vice presidential debate and Leo's performance as a debater. It might be terrible.
The episode or or his performance?
The synopsis, for sure. His performance.
It's not a great episode, I think.
Oh.
I'm not sure I'm willing to label it with terrible, but this was the first time certainly in a long time that I didn't buy the premise.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't love this episode the first time that I watched it, but then on subsequent viewings, I liked it a lot more.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. In the end, I think I liked this episode.
Wow. Okay, well, here's my problem, and it's right at the top of the episode. As you say, the A story is about Leo underperforming, to put it mildly, in debate prep and the concern that raises among his team about what's going to happen in front of the cameras. And the problem I had is in the opening scene, he actually seems to be dealing with like possible bout. I don't know if you have bouts of dementia, but he's so off. I mean, it was hard for me to, it's not like he was having trouble speaking English.
I need, that's a good answer. I'm going to need, this broke thing's a trap, isn't it? I'm leading with my chin here. These pre-canned. Can we take a break?
Leo, in that moment, I felt for him because he sounded like I do on this podcast before we edit everything together.
That is not true.
When he says healthcare in this country is broken and the Republican Congress's attitude is stronger. It's really the amount of second guessing that he does is what's really relatable and astonishing. And I felt very seen in that moment where he can't even get to the end of the sentence.
I don't think there's a comparison to be made there. But beyond trying to measure his tone or figure out how best to say it, he actually, at one point he says, is it broke or broken? That's just English. Like, he's wondering whether he's supposed to say the system is broke.
It's because he's queuing up the line, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right, but I don't know. It was weird. I felt like all of a sudden Leo's like, wait, the system is doorknob? No, broken. Wait, which am I supposed to, like, all of a sudden I'm like, what? Who is this guy? I mean, what is he going through? And John, always fantastic, was kind of broke my heart. I mean, he seems so vulnerable and so out of his element that I found it hard to buy. That feeling of stupefaction continued for me throughout the episode as he doesn't even necessarily seem to be aware of what happened because he wants to know from Josh, what did you think? And they're all lying. The whole thing just, I found it hard to buy.
Well, let me give you my theory on it. I can go along with your feeling of incredulity.
Nice, it's synonym time.
Really, for me, it's the change, you know, the delta in his performance between this first moment and then what we get at the end of the episode. He really is unable to complete a sentence here. And then in the end, he is relaxed, cogent, articulate, and, you know, does what he needs to do. But I'm willing to buy the explanation that he gives Annabeth at the end, where he says,
the truth. I was really that lost.
Oh, come on.
Couching answers in tame, time-pressured sound bites, and then when Josh would...
I think that is the thing that was really tricky for him. As Santos says in this episode,
every time you and I argue policy, you kick my ass.
And I think that what's really tripping up Leo here is the stilted performance part of it. Even just when we watched the presidential debate episode, those sort of last minute reminders that all the staff are giving Santos, you know, make sure you don't do this, make sure you do this, make sure you keep your answers like this, remember to say this, all those kinds of rules that they have to manage. I think, end up feeling paralyzing for Leo, and he can't access all the information that he actually has and all the skill he has naturally as a speaker.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I believe that explanation at the end, I just think they sort of would have arrived at that nugget of truth like 15 seconds into the cold open, where in his sort of charmingly irascible way, Leo would have said, I can't do this. I can't do it like this. I know you have pre-written things and you want me to hit that, whatever, but I gotta be me. I don't think it would have taken this sort of, first of all, weird cloud of confusion where nobody really knows what's going on, including Leo himself, and they're ripping up tapes and pretending it doesn't exist and he wants to see it to review it. I think he would have said, you know, after his first stumble and inability to kind of say a written line, he would have said, I can't do it like this. You know, I'm good at this. I don't know. It just, I kind of didn't buy that it would take 45 minutes of my time and however long it took in the universe of The West Wing to come to this realization. I mean, I certainly felt like it was hurtling towards a very good performance by Leo.
Sure.
And so I kind of felt like they took us to a fake place to give us what we would have ordinarily expected, which is Leo.
Right.
Leo is sharp. He's good on his feet. He's confident. And so I wish they had given us a realer, a more credible exploration of what's going on or why this wasn't working and why they would have been trying to box him in the first place and trying to prepackage the stuff he was going to say.
I think you're right about that. I was filling in the gaps with this idea that the campaign is running at such a breakneck pace that they don't even have the time or even the luxury of time to be able to analyze what's going wrong. They haven't even had a moment to practice this until the top of this episode. This is the first time they're realizing what it actually might be like. But yeah, a couple of sentences definitely could have helped to say, this has really snuck up on us. None of us have ever seen Leo in a public setting like this. We don't know what's going to happen. Something like that to reinforce it. I understand your misgivings.
Yeah, and I'm not sure why Leo wasn't able to put his finger on exactly what was tripping him up.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. And so the first time that I watched this, I was very distracted by this part of it. I was distracted by sort of the plot mechanics of Leo's debate performance. And then this very clear idea that Leo himself has leaked his poor performance. You know, we dance around it for so long in the episode, but obviously Leo is the one who has leaked that he is a bad debater to try and lower expectations. And he hasn't told his own team. And why he hasn't told his own team, I don't know. But he's keeping it from them. The whole thing to me felt, the first time I was watching it, I just kept feeling like I'd seen this before, like it was a version, like a riff on the joke at the top of Game On from season 4, when Toby, you know, is told that the president is having a crisis of confidence. And then the president gives him, you know, the terrible answer in the White House. And then,
right.
And then of course he's fine. And then he, you know, and Toby ends, he's like, he's ready. It's kind of what Leo is doing to the entire staff. Somewhere along the way, he knows he's punking them.
Yeah, right, exactly. A clever analogy that, of course, did not occur to me, but I do feel the same way. Yeah, that why didn't he just tell them, put them out of their misery, or let them know? It was kind of like, I kind of felt like Leo was respecting the no spoilers for the people who are watching the show.
Right, especially if he's going to break into Annabeth's email account and use that to be, like, what if she gets a follow-up call from one of the reporters that apparently...
Yes, that could have very easily happened.
Yeah, so I don't know why that part had to be secret. So I got really caught up in that, and it just felt strange. And yeah, like you said, we were being revved up for what was obviously going to be a fine performance by Leo. I actually like that he doesn't like blow the doors off the place, you know, that in the end his performance is good. That was actually the most satisfying part, that I was like, all right, they didn't take it to this place where he comes out and he is President Bartlett or something.
You're
like
right.
That
in a way is that probably most surprised me. I'm like, okay, they it was measured.
Yeah. So, like I said, the first time I watched that, I was caught up in this, and I didn't really think that I liked the episode that much. On subsequent viewings, though, knowing how all of this stuff plays out, it kind of slid into the background a little bit, and I'm like, I knew what was coming, and it allowed me to appreciate some of the other details in the episode, and I actually really love the details in this episode. There are a lot of great little moments and little lines and little exchanges that I found charming and amusing and and just nice. So it's a thumbs up with caveats for me, because it doesn't really feel fair to say, yeah, when you first watch the episode, it's a little distracting and maybe not that great. But when you watch it after the third time watching it, you really, really start to appreciate the great parts of it.
I regret now that I didn't beat myself senseless with multiple viewings. Apparently there's an anodyne effect where you just get numbed to the lesser aspects of the episode and you can enjoy the details. I'm looking forward to walking back through it with you now.
Yes, let's see if by the end of this, I make you like it a little bit more. Before we get to the fun stuff, though, we have to talk about the very sad stuff.
Yes, the opening from Martin.
Yeah, Martin Sheen, who is otherwise not in this episode, delivers a pre-episode address.
Good evening. On December 16th, we lost our dear friend and colleague, John Spencer. Through our shock and grief, we can think of no more fitting memorial to this wonderful man, this extraordinary actor, than to share with you, beginning tonight, the last few months of his work here on the West Wing. Johnny, it seems we hardly knew you. We love you, and we miss you.
That was a difficult thing to watch. It also felt like, I guess I don't remember having watched that, or that having been made, or maybe I didn't watch it, and maybe I never did. I'm sure I must have known that Martin was going to record a little statement, but it was just a weird blurring of something that's so personal, but making it public, and I think it was the right thing to do to kind of acknowledge what happened, the fact that we're still going to see him, and to make it, to frame it as a tribute, I thought was sweet and a nice touch. But there was something that made me feel uncomfortable about the sort of public, private nature of what happened and how to share it.
Yeah, the whole thing is so sad and so strange that, you know, just the way that TV production works, to have someone die and then say, well, we have several more weeks of their work to show you. I read that John Wells said in a press conference that there was, in fact, a debate about whether or not to air the other episodes as shot, or if they should reshoot them and sort of try and reframe them to account for what happened. And the decision was made to keep everything as it was filmed, because that was the best possible tribute for John Spencer and what they thought he would have wanted. They made a joke about. John Wells said, if you knew John, I think he would have been upset with me if we had actually changed scenes. Like, what? You're cutting my scenes, kid? What are you doing that for?
I think it was an apt decision. As anyone will tell you, and people have told us, John was the consummate, he was the actor's actor, and he loved it, and he loved this role on this series, and I think the correct tribute was to share his work.
This whole episode feels just painted in tragedy and irony, because the way that this episode and his death timed out, to make this announcement and say, oh, we're going to continue on because showing his work is the best tribute, and then to have an episode that features Leo so heavily, and I think some of John Spencer's best work in the series is included in this episode. It's remarkable that that's how things worked out.
Yeah, and knowing that he would be gone so soon after this also, I think, probably colored the way I watched it. There's a fragility and a frailty to him at times, to Leo, and it was hard not to imagine John himself frail, and that maybe also be part of what kind of took me out of this episode a little bit as a viewer.
It is hard to stay in the episode knowing what happens, because there are all these discussions of Leo's health. The parallels between Leo and John Spencer are impossible to ignore. And so every time they make a joke about Leo's health, it's really tough, and it is hard to stay in the story whenever any one of those lines come up. And there are several of them in this episode. At the very end, you know, when Josh is congratulating Leo for his performance, Leo says,
just never make me do this again.
In 4 years, book it.
You know, it's a line that's not meant to be ironic or anything other than congratulatory, but knowing what happened and with Martin's introduction, it just changes the meaning of so many lines like that.
Right, inevitably, sure.
Yeah. This makes us sort of face a editorial decision on the podcast a little bit about how to, I don't know, how to do something in recognition of this moment as well. And what I think, and I hope our listeners feel this is appropriate, is we're going to address this more deeply later when the series addresses what happens in the actual narrative as opposed to right now.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, let's get into the actual episode. I think there are a lot of funny moments in this episode.
Share some of them, won't you?
Maybe I was looking for gems. Maybe I was digging for pearls. What's the word here? Maybe I was panning for gold a little bit while I was trying. See, this is what I'm saying. I'm just like... Oh, God. Are we going to have to leave all of that in?
I'm leaking the tape.
Yeah. Okay. The first thing that made me chuckle was how high Bradley Whitford's voice goes up when Josh destroys the videotape and then tells Leo it was the only copy.
So, what was the report?
It was good. It's, you know, some bumps.
And all the times that the characters are trying to be nice to Leo in the face of how terrible he's doing cracked me up in this episode. I mean, the way Janine Garofalo has portrayed Lou is already so quickly and so clearly defined that, you know, when she struggles, when it's up to her, when it's her turn to try and give some kind of positive reinforcement to Leo, we just know how much it pulls against the actual fiber of her being.
Okay. That was good. You spent perhaps a little more time laying out the other side's position rather than your own. And the language was a bit dense.
She can barely get through it. I just thought her performance was fantastic there.
Not to knock any of the performances and also not to be a constant downer throughout, but I felt like some of those, that was one of the better moments of it, but some of that whole, we're lying to you and the audience knows it, and we all know it, but you don't know it. It feels like a sitcom to me. It feels like a sort of a stock sitcom situation and I don't love it. I kind of feel like Leo's smart. He's sharp. He knows he tanked. He's not going to believe you. Like, I just kind of, all of a sudden, I feel like now we're on Friends.
But I think on Friends, Leo would believe them. But what we find out is, of course, Leo doesn't believe them. He knows exactly what's going on. Nobody is fooling anybody, least of all Leo.
Right. So then why aren't they having a real conversation at this point? I mean, this is a very high stakes thing going on. So why are they all just fucking with each other? We're lying to him. He knows it. He's bullshitting us. And like, instead of going like, well, here's what I think. I think I need to.
Yeah. What I love too, though, in the end, is there's like the little soundbite from the newscast that ultimately deflates the whole thing by saying like, well, actually, the stakes aren't that high.
Well, that's true, too. You're right. Somebody says it's a vice presidential debate. Like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, wow.
We've treated it like it's this high stakes thing. And they're like, well, and in the end, he did a great job, which is to say nobody's running into the arms of the other candidate. It's fine.
I know that. That I was like, now you're calling out the part I was going to give you on credit. Like, there was a little part of me from the beginning that was thinking it is just a vice presidential thing. Like, why is everybody freaking out? But I was like, that part I can buy, that lack of credibility. And then someone calls it out later in the episode.
Yeah.
Who says Vinick's kids are approaching menopause? Was that Lou?
Donna says that.
Vinick's kids are approaching menopause. We want to get some
heartwarming. Oh, Donna does. I thought that was a very funny line. I wasn't expecting that.
Why is that so funny to you?
I mean, it's just such an extreme way of making her point that it made me laugh. It just caught me off guard.
Yeah. Okay, here's a line that sent me sort of drifting into other thoughts away from the show. At one point, Josh says,
I need you to look pretty for 20 million TV viewers.
That's what we're counting on. Campaign's doomed.
Which I thought really sounded like something Leo would say.
Yes.
And I liked it. But the tangential path it sent my mind down on was one where I just thought about all the actors who have to play roles that in the world of the film or the episode or whatever it is that they're doing, they play a character who is supposed to be unattractive. Like where characters act or say things in a way that is supposed to be factually somehow that they are unattractive. And, you know, juxtaposing that with being in a career where people are supposed to look at you and you have to like get a job based on your appearance and things like that.
You're vicariously bruised on their behalf.
Yeah, exactly. When I just think about all the auditions and rejections and all the judgment, all the horrible stuff that goes along with being an actor in the first place. And then it's like, you get the job. By the way, your job is ugly man number two.
Yes, it does. It takes you out of the moment because you're feeling for, I have this, this is, I guess, like a corollary. I don't like when little kids are crying in scenes because I'm like, that kid is crying.
Actually crying.
That kid, they shook him around or something, like, or they waited there, like, he is upset, let's roll, let's go. I'm just like, that kid is really upset. And it takes, even though it heightens the verisimilitude of whatever's being done. It takes me out of it because I feel bad for the kid.
Yeah.
And I do have a similar thing when people are called upon to, you know, somehow shame themselves or are shamed in the scene for something physical.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember watching an episode of Insecure and, you know, there's a double date, like a blind date that gets set up, and one guy comes in and he's like really hot and he's, you know, set up with one friend, and then the other friend gets this other guy and she is visibly disappointed with his looks, you know, and that's sort of like, that's the rest of that part of the episode. And I just thought, like, what a heartbreaking way to have like a professional win.
And I'm sure in total it's so hard to get work that I know I'd play super ugly guy number two in a second happily. But I do get your point.
Yeah. Anyway, back from my tangent, that line is all made up for me in this episode by the fantastic dynamic between Leo and Annabeth in the whole episode. It took me a little while to like figure out how she fits into this, you know, what the groove is that she fits into in this machinery of this show. But once they paired Annabeth and Leo together, it really came together for me. I love their chemistry.
I liked the smirk scene.
Yeah.
I don't like when it gets playfully faux sexual. That's not my favorite of their kind of interactions. But I did like her sort of manhandling his face. And it was also, I thought Peter Noah... Leo does. I mean, John has a sort of twinkle in his eye kind of smirk. That's one of the just great things. It's hard for me just at rest not to imagine John with that smirk. So I like that they built a whole scene around her advice about it. I thought that was kind of a right on, and it was a charming scene between the two of them.
I want you to break down your uncomfortableness with the flirtatious elements to their dynamic.
Hey, look at me. Gorgeous.
I'll get her away from me.
Man cannot take a compliment.
Oh, sure. You know, it's like when a waiter comes over to an older person and says, "Why are you laughing already?" Your laughing is making me laugh. I'm not even making me laugh. Why is this funny?
It's already funny. I'm just, okay, go ahead. Keep going.
When a waiter walks over, is it just the service industry that's funny? A waiter will walk over to an elderly gentleman and say, "And what'll you have, young man?"
Oh, wow.
It's like she's saying, "I'm getting hot looking at you, and this is funny because I'm not."
But she is. It's already been established. She, you know, Leo suggests.
I didn't buy it in the elevator. I don't buy it in the debate prep room.
Oh, I like it.
When I'm older... and I'm talking 5 to 7 years from now, and someone comes over and says, what would you like to drink, young man? There's going to be some fisticuffs.
That's fair enough.
I like to drink your blood.
Fair enough. I don't liken the dynamic here to that one. I think that if you want to punch out a waiter for, say, calling you young man, I understand. I'm not saying I approve, but I understand. But I don't think that's what's going on here. I think that...
So you think there's an actual sexual vibe between these two?
Yes.
All right.
I think that Leo is clearly feeling awkward about it and teased by it. And I don't know that he would necessarily say that there is, but Annabeth has put it out there previously that there is. And she's just like leaning into it. Where I take exception to your metaphor or your analogy is that waiter says to the older person, "What will you have, young man?" It's a joke because it's not true. But what Annabeth is saying is your smirk can be devastatingly sexy in the right context. And I think... yes, clearly. John Spencer has so much charisma and is a handsome dude. And that look and his energy absolutely could be devastatingly sexy. I would say that she's being patronizing or joking.
All right. We'll leave it at that.
He's a charmer, I think.
I certainly found John Spencer charming and find Leo charming. I'll sign off on.
All right. I don't mind being teased by women in this way. Like a woman teasing me, saying that I'm handsome when I know that she's joking, it doesn't totally bother me because there's some part of my mind that gets to live a little bit in the fiction that she might not be joking.
Huh.
And just that little imaginary space that lives somewhere between the reality of everything feels...
Well, I can understand if you're actually not sure that it would be a little bit titillating and you can lean towards, she probably means it. But if you know she doesn't mean it and you live in the fiction, you might as well just when someone says hello, live in the fiction that they say, hey, you're handsome. A woo, wah, wah.
Josh, let me tell you a little something about my...
Is that what hello means to you?
I have no idea. Of the world.
Okay, fair enough. We're getting to know you.
Okay, speaking of being on camera, here's a part of the episode that I did not like, and not because I thought that it was not done well, but because I just didn't like it. And I found myself feeling a little bit resentful of the episode for having introduced the subplot in the first place. Again, not because it was done badly, but there's a storyline here where there's a photo op gets set up by the Santos campaign. When the candidate arrives home, he greets his children outside of his house. The press can see. They take pictures. It's going to be great. Except it backfires, so to speak.
Well done.
This plot line bums me out, so to speak.
Yeah. But, so to speak. Yeah. I didn't love it either. Starting from when Santos gets out of the car knowing there's a photo op and still whistles at his kid like it's a dog.
And the kid runs over, and they had to actually make a kid run to do that.
That's right, which I find heartbreaking. I won't have it.
Just to recap, do the recapping part of this, in the middle of this sweet, charming, though staged scene, you know, that mixes the genuine and the artificial, at one point, you know, the kids are sick. Helen wipes their son's nose and the cameras take a picture of, oh, Jesus, I don't even like saying it, you know? I don't even like talking about it.
Do you not want to say thong? Is that it?
I just don't like talking about the whole thing. Anyway, yeah, so they take a picture that, you know, you can see her underwear. You can see that she has a tattoo on her lower back. They take a picture of it and then the tabloid prints it. And though this tells a story of the world that is accurate, I think, one that is grimy and cheap and horrible, I turn to the West Wing for a respite from that kind of griminess.
You know, I'm with you. It's interesting. In fact, I was watching the episode in the kitchen, at the kitchen table on my laptop with my wife puttering around the kitchen behind me. And I was heckling a little bit here and there. And I started to verbally lay it on. I think for the same reasons right then. I was saying, oh no, this is what the story is? And I think I felt the same way. You articulated better. I just had a negative reaction. But I think that is what it was. Like, you are right that it's spot on the kind of thing that might well happen. Even the insert shot of the, whatever, tabloid page itself, right. The way they had a magnified, zoomed in,
yes,
on the underwear is exactly what they would have done.
Yeah.
That kind of thing does happen all the time. But I think you're right. It took us to a place I'd rather not go when I'm watching The West Wing. But maybe that's unfair, but I think I also was kind of turned off by the storyline.
Right. I mean, the reason why The West Wing has the reputation that it has is because it portrays things, you know, perhaps the way that we wish things were and not necessarily as they are. This was a storyline that felt very much like the way things are. You know, it reveals a misogynistic double standard that exists and the absolute injustice of the kind of scrutiny that spouses of candidates have to undergo, despite not being the one who's actually running for office. All this puritanical garbage, like hypocritical puritanical garbage that this country is, you know, seemingly obsessed with.
It's trash journalism. The lowest kind of tabloid stuff. This will backfire.
I think the idea of a plot line that shows the kind of specific scrutiny that a candidate's spouse gets would have been interesting. This is not the one that I wanted to see.
Yeah, I think fair enough. Ultimately, you and I are very cultured, sophisticated gentlemen, and we found it a bit vulgar. All right, I think that's the bottom line right there.
Oh, geez, so to speak.
So to speak.
Okay, that said, I thought that the actual substance of this grimy plot line was handled well. I especially liked the way that Terry Polo performed this entire episode.
I agree. I thought it was a terrific performance. And I also thought it was interesting that the immediate reaction that Peter Noah gave her in the script was to be speechless.
I guess it's a speechless.
I thought that was kind of great. It was good writing and a terrific performance. I mean, I felt horrible for her, the humiliation that she was now going to have to face. And I thought it was handled very well.
I especially liked how it's contrasted with the kind of outrage that she was able to have before this happened. You know, when the grievances were about the extra security and the long hours and all the things that kind of, all the unfair things that go along with just running for office that a family has to endure, she had a little mini rant with Santos talking about all of this stuff. But then when the focus shifts to this instead, her reaction is not to be outraged. It is really like she withdraws and gets quiet and like resigned in a way that is really effective and so heartbreaking.
Yeah, I agree. But and then there's also actually, I thought, an interesting sort of along the lines of the, well, it's a vice presidential debate, doesn't matter anyway line. Donna kind of had a little bit of a figurative slap on the face.
The option to be left alone took a hit when the congressman signed on a run and pretty much got obliterated once he gained the nomination. It'll be a distant memory when he wins this thing. Might be time for you to start talking about the kind of first lady you want to be. I'd like to help you with that if you let me.
Can't tell you what kind of first lady I'd like to be. Too busy deciding if I want him to win.
Yeah, that was great. We talked about the smirk scene with Leo. I actually think the best smirk of the episode goes to Jimmy Smits when he and Helen are having this exchange where she's upset about all the additional security and things like that. She's talking about the barbecue and how her mother had to wear an ID tag.
My mother walking around tagged like she was some threatening wacko.
Slightly out of focus behind her, Jimmy Smits actually has a great smirk for a second until Helen says,
if you're considering this an opportunity to crack a mother-in-law joke, you are seriously misjudging the mood of your audience.
This is one of the details that later I really, really appreciated, how their dynamic as a couple in this moment. Mm-hmm. Santos lets the silence kind of sit for a second. And when he comes back and he says, oh, I had a real good one, she actually laughs. Like, she knows that they're okay. And then my favorite thing is the way Jimmy Smits delivers the next line where he just says,
too late.
Yeah, it's pretty good. They're a very credible couple, I agree.
And then he says, I'm sorry. And as we mentioned in a previous episode, that we are here for all your marital advice, unasked for marital advice. I'm just going to say, this is some great marriage work done here, and all married people could learn something from this scene. And the effectiveness of him, you know, listening to her, keeping his mouth shut, making a little joke when he knows the timing is right, and then giving her a sincere apology.
Right.
A sincere apology is got to be the most valuable currency in a relationship, don't you think?
Yes, I do. I'm working on it.
And then we get Leo dispensing with some marriage advice that, and I love that too, where he says,
my best advice, don't get on a plane angry.
But then also the irony of someone who's been divorced giving marriage advice, and, you know, does that make it better or does it make it worse that he's divorced?
I think that phone call was my favorite scene of the episode.
Yeah.
There's something about it that just the tone of it, they got just right in the writing and the performances. And I thought it was just, it was sweet. It was charming. It was a moment away from the hectic nature of the campaign. And I felt like, oh, these two guys really like each other.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see that.
Yeah, me too.
And they see some value in each other and they can have this just kind of personal moment. I liked it a lot.
Me too. I love the evolution of their relationship that this scene allows us to see, you know, from that moment where Josh had been trying to get them together, you know, in the beginning of this season where they didn't know each other yet. And Josh knew that if he could just get them to sit down and just talk a little bit, they'd find common ground. And now all these weeks later, you can see the fruits of that labor in this scene.
Well said.
One other detail in that scene between Matt and Helen Santos, I really like Helen's earrings in that scene. They're very nice.
I didn't notice.
She's got that beautiful dress on, very nice earrings. And then we find out in this conversation that she didn't actually even get to go.
Yeah, that's right.
She got all dressed up for that and she didn't even go to the event because she had to stay home with their sick kids.
That's right. I had that Lou, I noticed, in true Toby fashion, says,
I know what you're going to say.
Go ahead.
It was the next thing that I was going to bring up in myself, actually.
She says,
and Leo sound like you could care less.
How can
Lou? Oh, Lou, I almost felt like the podcast itself has come full circle and we should just stop here.
Lou, in fact, it is Josh who could care less about your misuse of couldn't care less.
Boom.
How about Will and Kate? Speaking of some...
I don't know. I don't know. I didn't enjoy my performance in this episode. I'll say maybe it's just I was just so tuned out to the. I wasn't enjoying the experience altogether. That I didn't find me charming at all. I'm glad she did, but yeah,
I didn't actually say that I did yet, Josh.
No. I'm not suggesting that you did. I'm suggesting that she clearly did.
She did. I'm sorry. Sorry.
Yeah. No. I'm saying she seems rather taken with him. He's doing well. I don't get it. I don't see it. Although I did when we finally had the meal itself and he had his, candlelight and the takeout food and they were going to watch the debate. And I liked that Peter had him refer to it as a first date and she picks up on that and he says, hey, I'm an optimist. I was like, okay, now we're cooking. Now I can see a little appeal. But for much of it, I was like, nah, I don't know.
I liked that scene because it was one of those moments that I've mentioned on the podcast before where something in the physicality of you switching salads with her, I saw a little bit of Josh Molina in that Will Bailey action.
There was some, I forget what you call it now. There was a little bit of
cheap thrills.
There is some very minor cheap thrills. You had to look closely for it. There's some a little twirl, a little utensil handling, a little flipping of the lid of the salad away.
Exactly.
Thank you for noticing. Yes, I appreciate
it. I noticed it. Because I do think that, you really have created a character that is separate from you in Will Bailey. I mean, between the writing and your performance, I never look at the show and think, oh, that's Josh being Josh. I recognize that as Will Bailey. And the reason I know that is because every now and then there are these moments where I see something and I'm like, that's not just Will, that's Josh right there.
There's the Venn diagram. There's the overlay.
Yeah, exactly. It's not just the face.
That's right. What else? Oh, yeah. Let's not just rush past the salads. I had two problems with the salads. First of all, they looked identical to each other.
They did look identical, I thought.
I was like, those are two of the same salads. And if it's Carciofi, where the f*** are the artichokes? Because I didn't see an artichoke.
Nope.
That looked like a very, very basic salad, and it looked like two. I'll take two of your most basic salads. This is a big date.
Yeah, it really was a lack of detail in the salad design there.
A little bit. I was like, props. What the hell? They're exactly the same. It is nice to say, this looks better. Please, you take it.
Yep.
But not if it's the same thing.
And not if it's the same thing, and neither of them is the thing that has been described.
What they're purported to be in the first place.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Which is funny because there are some details in the props in this episode. One that I will mention is in that tabloid that you talked about with the insert, there is a piece of text at the bottom of the page that says, we'll take you, quote, behind the scenes with Helen, an exclusive interview with the lady in red, which made me laugh because one, they bothered to put like the dumb pun in the tabloid, but two, how did that tabloid get an exclusive interview with Helen Santos?
I think they're lying. That's very funny. Or maybe I think there's a Gene Wilder movie, The Lady in Red. So maybe it was the actress from that.
Oh, okay.
It was just a little bait and switch, a little misdirection.
Mm-hmm. With the Will Kate stuff, one thing that that cracked me up was that there are two scenes in this episode that end with like a lingering shot on your face. Like it goes the cute back and forth. It's very quick and kind of quippy between the two characters. And then both times Kate says something and then we end with a reaction shot on Will that lasts like a little too long and is like slightly goofy and weird. No offense.
Yeah.
I think it's how Will is reacting to it and it seems genuine, but it felt funny when it happened the second time.
Yeah. Maybe just a terrible mistake in editing.
And I think because it also felt like a repeat of, like this has become like a little trope between them because when Kate asked Will to the wedding and she says, do you have a tux? She says, do you want to go to the wedding with me? Will does not actually answer. He didn't say yes.
That moment was held a little bit too long.
It was held a little bit on.
I felt the same way.
On your face. And so I think watching this episode after that episode, I was like, every time there's a little cute flirty moment between the two of them, the button, though that punim is as cute as a button.
It needed a real button.
The button is actually.
I agree with you.
Yeah, it's always just a. And now Will looks surprised and happy and flummoxed and cute.
Yeah, I don't love those moments either. I'm sure I didn't love playing them, and I didn't love the end result there. And you're right, it's also like, all right, we've done this.
Yeah.
Vic has one of those in the previous episode where Debbie Fitterer is offering him different drinks.
Uh-huh.
He says, no, no, no. And she says, you want a Valium?
Yes.
And it just kind of holds on him.
Yeah.
For maybe a beat too long. Although there's at least a little comic payoff in, oh, he...
Maybe he does want a Valium. Yeah.
Right.
Another moment I liked in this episode is when they're doing the second round of debate prep with Leo.
Yes.
And Otto, who was subbing in for Ray Sullivan, and in the first, you know, in the first round... was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Vicious really like kind of went for it and basically mopped the floor with Leo, gets told by Josh, hey, remember, we're trying to build confidence, so hold back a little. And then immediately Lou says, this is only useful if it's real, don't hold back.
I like that too.
Yeah. And poor Otto has to deal with both pieces of conflicting information, and you can see he doesn't know what to do with it. I just thought that part was cute.
Me too.
Okay, here's another... piece of the episode that I really liked and felt tragically connected to.
Yes.
This scene when Josh accuses the rest of the team of possibly leaking Leo's debate performance. Lou says, I haven't spoken to a friend in 2 months. Annabeth says, I don't think I have any friends left. And Rana, my true soulmate in this scene, says,
all my friends are in this room. Okay, you win most pathetic.
That was great. Josh Watson, all my friends are in this room. And Josh, you aren't even in this room.
Oh.
I appreciated that there was a moment in this episode that kind of set things up. There's a moment of exposition in the Vinnick headquarters talking about Leo's status as a possible debater.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I really liked it. I think because of where it appeared in the episode, you know, about like 16 minutes in, Sullivan says,
McGarry is verbal and tough.
It's one thing to argue behind the scenes. It's a whole other ballgame doing it in debate setting.
Concerned about presentation, tone.
Clarity.
Concision.
It's hard enough for veteran politicians, let alone a neophyte like McGarry.
Well, Leo's no neophyte.
But being a candidate, he is.
If that exact same scene had appeared in the cold open, or even like whatever, at the beginning of Act One,
mm-hmm.
it would have felt clunky and, you know, DJ exposition-ish.
Right.
But where it fell is sort of like all these things had been kind of established in some ways, and here they were just kind of putting a finer point on it, and it felt like a real conversation that could exist between these characters.
Interesting point. Yeah, I agree.
Is this working at all? Are you liking the episode anymore as I talk about all these scenes that I like?
No.
All right.
But I'm enjoying our chat.
You know, there's this other thing running through this episode, which is that Santos is kind of handling his kids from a distance for the most part, for the majority of the episode.
Doesn't want to get sick.
Yeah. And Helen kind of gives him a little bit of a hard time about it, but I appreciated his concern.
As did I.
I was talking to Maggie Rogers, singer-songwriter Maggie Rogers, who was on Song Exploder a while back. I was talking to her recently, and she was saying that part of her job is to not get sick. And she's absolutely right. You know, in addition to writing songs and then traveling and performing them in concert and doing press and all this stuff, when you're on tour, you have to take your health as seriously as any other aspect of the job.
Absolutely. I know plenty of actors who are, you know, almost hypochondriacal in that sense. And certainly singers and, you know, musical actors are very serious about their instrument and their voice and trying to stay in good voice. And if you're doing a show in New York, it's 8 episodes a week. And so, yeah, that is, I think if you're a presidential candidate, yeah, I don't think Bernie took very good care of his voice leading up to this most recent Democratic contender debate.
The rasp heard round the world.
Indeed.
Because all of the gears grind to a halt if you have to suddenly take a day off or something like that.
That's right.
So I appreciate it.
I was with Matt on that one too.
Yeah. But by the end of the episode, you can see that his defenses have been worn away, much like an immune system after too much travel. And so I think you see in a couple instances. One, he goes to try and comfort his daughter when she says she's sick, even though she does not want him.
What's wrong, Angel?
I want mommy.
Okay.
But then also I thought it came through a little bit in his reaction to his clearly very annoying brother.
Yes.
His brother shows up and wants a favor.
Listen, I invited over a couple business associates for drinks and a photo. Think we can get them past your stormtroopers?
The whole thing sounds sketchy, but I think that Santos has been so burdened by his own sense of guilt about what he's done or not done for his family, what inconveniences he's caused for them, mm-hmm. that when this request comes in, he just says, all right.
Yeah. Yeah, he's been ground down.
Yeah. And poor Bram is the one who actually has to deal with it.
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk to Matthew Del Negro later this episode.
That's right.
We'll get his take on his whole experience. This is not a Bram-centric, particularly Bram-heavy episode, but we'll talk to Matthew about his West Wing experience all around.
Yeah, it's not Bram-heavy. You wouldn't say it weighs a kilogram.
Nice. I was trying to work my way towards that, but I couldn't remember how many Brams are in an ounce. 28? Is it 28? I haven't sold drugs in so many years, I couldn't make the joke.
I was going to say that maybe FBI is listening, but you know, there's a chance that somebody from the FBI is listening. I thought the brief but excruciating scene of Santos trying to just go get his mail was very effective.
Sir, did you want to go somewhere?
I was just going to get the mail.
Of course, sir. We'll just need a few minutes to shut down the street.
To walk to the mailbox?
Anytime you go into the front yard.
Yes, but I didn't believe that that hadn't happened before. This is his last visit home. He's never had this mail moment.
Maybe he hasn't been home since winning the primary.
I don't know. Maybe. It's just another subplot that kind of was a little bit weak for me because I felt like, they should be used to this already. Yes, they have a bunch of people whose job it is to keep you safe and alive. And yes, it's a bummer.
But the part that I liked the most from that was the fact that they have to shut down the entire street. It's one thing for Helen to complain about the inconvenience and the toll that it takes on the family, because that's at least a decision that a family can make together when someone decides to run. But the burden that it puts on just his neighbors who happen to live on the same street as them is something that I had not thought about yet.
Yeah, that's true. And Helen has a funny line.
All right, the guys with dark glasses, I'm posted around the house.
Are you kidding? They now live on the safest block in America.
But I like that spotlight. I hadn't considered it. It was this little moment that did it for me.
And I like the hand signals that the Secret Service guy started to give. And then you saw people in the far background start to run off. It was well done.
Yeah.
Well done, Paul McCrane.
Another cute exchange, I thought, was the phone call between Josh and Toby.
I'll talk to you in 6 weeks.
Election day.
I forget, in D.C. they let felons vote? Too soon?
Just a little bit.
See ya.
Richard Schiff is so good that you know that he knows that Josh is joking. You also know that he really means it when he says that it's just a little bit. And then but he's still also smiling when he says, see ya. Like, there's so much layered in that little tiny bit of dialogue between these two characters and friends.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I like that.
I love that.
I was glad they were still speaking.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that too. That made me feel happy that things have continued to get better for them from their confrontation at Toby's apartment in round one of that. Also, on the West Wing, you can say assholic.
All right. I wasn't sure I wanted to talk to you. Last time you were more than usually assholic.
Yes, they did say assholic.
I don't like that either.
I'm offended.
Speaking of puritanical garbage, I did not like that. But here's the thing I didn't like in the most nitpicky of ways.
Sure.
Josh calls Toby on the day of the vice presidential debate.
Mm-hmm.
It has previously been established in the episode that the VP debate is happening on a Sunday. Toby is in court, a busy courthouse, saying he's in between arraignments.
On a Sunday. Look at you.
How's he doing that on a Sunday?
Good bust. That's a good bust.
Thank you. Just make the VP debate on Monday.
That's all you have to do.
That's all you have to do.
Or I just have a little open 24/7 neon sign somewhere in the background at the court.
There's a great moment where Santos is sort of hyping up. He's doing the opposite of lowering expectations.
I have every confidence that when Leo McGarry challenges Ray Sullivan on the issues, he's going to show that the Vinnick campaign's so-called sensible solutions are neither sensible nor solutions.
And I thought, it's Linda Richmond. Coffee talk with Linda Richmond. Anybody who does not know, you must know. On SNL, we have some young listeners, they might not know. On Saturday Night Live, Mike Myers used to do this character, Linda Richmond. And sometimes Linda Richmond would talk about something, get upset, she'd get verklempt. And then while she tried to recover, she would give the audience something to discuss. She's like, talk amongst yourselves, I'll give you a topic. And then she would say something like, Dr. Pepper was neither a doctor nor Pepper.
Discuss.
And the peanut is neither a pea nor a nut. there are some good ones. Rafe Fiennes is spelled neither Rafe nor Fiennes.
You did your research.
The one that immediately came to mind was, the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. Discuss. Which is actually a reference to Voltaire.
What?
Yeah. So layers on layers in that one.
Yeah, indeed.
So yeah, Santos was channeling a little Linda Richman. I think the best part of the Helen subplot, griminess and all, is the moment that it provides for Donna, who, by the way, has shown in this episode she is so fully integrated in the top tier of this campaign.
That's right.
It gives her a moment to reach out and help Helen craft this sense of identity for what kind of first lady she might be, something that they haven't talked about before. And I thought that was awesome. I love that Donna, you know, sees that opportunity. I mean, she's been doing very well throughout the whole episode, you know, and she's doing a great job on the campaign. But here now, she's able to carve out territory for herself that no one has staked so far. And really, you know, it's been a missed opportunity up until this point. I mean, like you said, I like that exchange between them when Helen says, well, I'm not running for president. And she says, with all due respect, we both know you're not that naive.
Yeah. It's a little bit of an iron fist in a velvet glove moment, exactly, which
yeah.
I liked.
Yeah. I think Donna is fully a badass and she's using her experience and her instincts to their fullest power here and really helping.
Right on. We're going to take a quick break now for a few ads, and then we're going to hop back on the mics and talk to Matthew Del Negro.
And now back to our show.
Hey, this is Matthew Del Negro. I played Bram Howard from Venezuela.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. I heard that too, and I was like, yeah, that one, when it came out in the script, I was like, really?
What is your family background?
Italian.
So
100% Italian. Yeah, it was fine, but I remember being like, Bram, though? I'm like, Bram sounds like very waspish or something. It doesn't sound Venezuelan.
Everything about that line was surprising when it happened.
It's all about the dinero.
That's money, right?
I liked how you guys kind of roasted it. I got to tell you, it was very interesting watch. I have not seen The West Wing in a long time. I was like, wow, that was the job that brought me out to LA. So there was a lot wrapped up in it. And then also I didn't really have very much to do.
So wait, you booked this from out of town?
Yeah, I actually booked this. I was out here for pilot season and I went in for what I thought was going to be a guest spot. Jason Ensler was directing. Eli had written the episode. It was La Palabra. And went in, didn't feel particularly good about the audition, actually. Like, I kind of came out like, ah, that's too bad. And then got it, went to the fitting, and met Philip Heyman, who was worked in on Lynn's team.
I remember Philip.
And he was like, during the fitting, like, you get a lot of information. He was like, you should really be good, because I think they're kind of like auditioning people to do this whole, you know, the storyline on the campaign trail or whatever. And I was scared shitless to do the show, and I was so prepared. And then La Palabra, I had all these, you know, walk and talks through the hallways where I was leading Smits and Whitford and all these people. And it never dropped anything, because it was just out of fear, you know, that I was okay. So, and then it ended up turning into more.
It is so true, by the way, that my wife, Melissa, of 23 years, used to work in wardrobe, and they are the people to talk to about. I would always do that, even on Scandal. I'd be like, Lynn, at a time when I wasn't guaranteed all episodes, I was like, am I in the next one? She's like, well, I shouldn't tell you, but here isn't that. They've got all the information. They know much more than anybody else.
Totally. Wardrobe and hair and makeup, same thing. You learn a lot right in the trailer. Yeah.
That is true.
Yeah. And then they brought me back in the finale of the sixth season. And then they invited me to the rap party at the end, and I was about to go back to New York, and Alex Graves was like, I'll see you next summer, or I'll see you, you know, at the end of the summer or something. And I was like, really? Could you put that in writing? He's like, oh, you'll be back. and then I was in New York, and they called, and they said, you know, even that, it was like, we're guaranteeing you three out of the first five. And I came out and I did those, and it just kind of kept going and kept going. And I got a kick out of listening to you guys with the telebram.
Yes.
Because I used to say, Is there a script where it doesn't say Bram hovers? Like that's what that, it would always be whatever, and like Bram hovers. And I watched last night, and I was like, I'm embarrassed that I was even coming on to do this with you guys, because I'm watching, and I'm like, I'm just kind of lurking around and then drop a couple of things here and there. It's very, very funny.
Well, did you agree with our assessment that occasionally Bram is called upon to ask a question, the answer to which he probably knows, just so that the audience member members can hear the explanation.
Who's Al Smith anyway?
First Catholic to run for president, 1928.
Why is a dinner such a big deal?
Totally. I mean, yeah, a lot of it was, you know, we actually, Karis Campbell and Ramon de Ocampo and myself and Evan Arnold in the beginning, you know, he was Ned, and then
before he got fired.
We used to joke and say that we were going to have a spinoff called AIDS. Because we were always there, and we were always like, we're kind of on this show, right? Like, you know, I was always like trying to, you know, shimmy into the back of a frame, that kind of thing.
That description resonates with me as well. There are a lot of times where I'm like, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were given enough to start to get a sense of Bram's character and, you know, your way into expressing the role?
Yeah, I think I was. I mean, there were some episodes where I was given a little bit more. And one of the things I did, and Eli was kind, you know, Eli wrote that first episode, and then I just kind of became friends with him, still friends with him to this day. And he always said, he's like, you know, you nailed it. I know these guys that did this, and you got it. And really, it was like the kind of role where you stay out of the way.
You met Backus in San Francisco at the Giants game. Daughter's an honor student at Loyola. Congratulate him on his wife's thyroid operation.
So it was successful.
Don't mention the thyroid operation.
You get it done. You don't bring a lot of attention to yourself. You don't slow anybody down, and you are serving. In that case, I was serving Santos. You know, it's like, I'm just his guy. And Jimmy was such a great guy that was easy to do. So it was like, as the actor and as the character, it was very much the same relationship, you know. And he really was that, you know, I don't know, I'm sure listeners know him, and you guys have probably talked about him or his character on this show. But my first memory of Jimmy Smits was my first day of shooting. We shot at the ranch, you know, across the street from Warner Brothers. And they got us a van back to where the trailers were. And he was like in the back of the trailer, which, first of all, that's not generally where, you know, the guy who's higher on the call sheet is sitting. So he sat there. And then we pull up to his trailer, and people are starting, they're like, oh, Jimmy, here you go. And like, people are starting to move out of the way so he can get out of the van. He's like, no, 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 I'm good. And he literally, like, he climbed over the back seat of the trailer and like shimmied out of the back of the van to get to his trailer. And it's just like, wow, that was my experience of him, was he was just this kind of a really big heart and a warm person, but not in a BS way. When he was working, he was working. It wasn't like you were, you know, he wasn't doing it to try to be liked. He just really was a good guy, you know?
Yeah, I think that comes across in his portrayal of Santos too, that warmth.
Totally, yeah.
What was the episode that you watched last night?
I watched Running Mates last night, and as it started, I was like, did they ask me to do this show, an episode that I'm not in? Because I actually couldn't remember. I remember the debate, and I was like, I thought this is one that I was like written out of. And then as it went, I started to remember, I was like, okay, you know, it's funny. Like, I remember where we filmed somewhere near Pasadena, that all the stuff when we go back to Jimmy's house, and it was in like Altadena or somewhere over there. And I was kind of separated from my AIDS crew in this episode. I was on my own. But the one thing also I remember on that first episode was working with Brad Whitford, and I had known him from having seen the show a little bit, and I did not realize how funny he was, and just as a guy. I mean, he would just kill the entire set, and then boom, they'd call action, and he would go.
Exactly. From one second to the next, he goes right into it.
I feel like he was so loose as Josh, so loose. It was just effortless. It was great to watch that.
I was going to say that West Wing and Sopranos is a pretty heavy-duty 1-2 punch early in a career.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's funny. When I got to West Wing, I was there for a little while, and somebody, it might have even been Dylan Masson, came up to me and was like, what was it like on the set of Sopranos? And I'm like, oh, you knew I was on the Sopranos? You know, you forget, but that job, I always say Sopranos is the job that keeps on giving, because you get jobs way down the line and people ask you about that. And West Wing's the same way. And Scandal's sure. kind of the same way, actually,
mm-hmm.
where they were these, you know, they had something to them. And a common thread, I just told this to someone was asking me the other day, all three of those shows did cast table reads. I don't know if that's coincidence that they were, but do you do, I don't know. I don't feel like most shows do cast table reads.
No, I agree with you. I think they're standouts. I think it speaks to an approach to the material, to ensemble work, and to the people in charge, you know, originally Aaron and then Shonda. I can't speak to Sopranos. You beat me there. I got 2 out of 3. But yeah, I think it speaks to an approach and a kind of a respect for the work that you don't always get given the time crunch of TV production.
Yeah.
Did you two have much interaction on The West Wing?
I don't think we had any.
Not on camera. We met each other.
That's what I was wondering.
But that's also one of the nice things about table reads, which obviously isn't necessarily reflected on what's ultimately on screen, but you get to meet the people that you don't get to work with.
Yeah.
You at least get to sort of touch base and say hello and introduce yourselves and kind of get on that same page.
Yeah. I mean, on that show, it was just interesting because kind of what we had heard, everybody that was on the Santos campaign, was that, you know, the diehard fans were like, oh, this is BS that they're doing all that. Like, they wanted you guys back and that we were like the scrubs coming in. So it was like you guys would be over there and we were like this, you know, rogue unit that was on the campaign trail. So it was almost like it was two different shows, you know?
How about, was there a talk or buzz or a feeling that you guys might become more featured if the show continued beyond where it finally did? I mean, there must have been some hope brewing there.
There was talk of it. And then you hear things. I don't know what's what. But first of all, John Spencer, may he rest in peace. What a great, great dude. I had heard different reasons of why they pulled it. I don't know if they're true. It is kind of shocking. It was really a good show. Even at the end, it's kind of shocking that it didn't continue on, but...
I mean, I don't even really know, and hopefully we'll get into it and talk to some people who really do, but my sense was just that it was a numbers thing and how much it cost to make and a question of whether the network was willing to continue with it, and I think ultimately they weren't. But I do think John Wells and company were good to go and planning to continue.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I was asking about how much interaction you two had on West Wing was what that was like then when you were both on Scandal. Did you have any kind of feeling of reunion of,
oh yeah, we were really happy to see each other. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When I saw Josh on Scandal, I was kind of like, hey.
Yeah. I was very psyched to see you too.
It's like seeing someone from high school, you know, on vacation.
Yeah. I'm excited to figure out what we're going to do next.
Yeah. I it's going to be very interesting.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on City on a Hill on Showtime. It's the Kevin Bacon, Boston cop drama, Matt Damon, Ben Affleck thing. And their company, Tom Fontana, is running it. It got a second season. Sadly, I did a Netflix comedy that I loved, like one of the best. Did you see it? Huge in France?
Yes, I did. Of course. I wanted to watch you. I really dug it. That's No More?
No, dude. I mean, talk about, we were like, what? I've never gotten that kind of feedback from, like, you know, people in my town that wrote for The Office and they're like, when are you doing season 2? I got to play an actor. So it was fun. I mean, I just got to send up everything about what we do.
Exactly. Very funny in it.
Those guys, Andy Mogul and Jared Paul, their tone is just right up my alley, you know? So that was sad not to go, but City on a Hill is pretty cool. So that's what I'm doing right now. I'm waiting. We're in between.
Oh, right on. So I haven't watched that yet. So I guess you have to do a Boston accent.
I got to do a f-ing Boston accent. Yeah.
There it is.
Nice. Can you swear on the West Wing Weekly or you got to be all f-ing proper?
We'll bleep you out.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That's pretty good.
Hey, Rishi knows.
I went to school in Boston. So it's like I'm finally putting that Boston College education, you know, to use finally after all these years.
Good. Yeah, I had little Proustian palpitations there. I felt like I was going to get beat up.
I want to make sure we talk about his podcast.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about your podcast.
Oh, yeah. So the podcast is, well, we talked about getting to the White House and then the show is over. It's called 10,000 No's. So it's all about overcoming rejections, overcoming adversity. And I talk to not just our industry. I do have a lot of writers, directors, actors, producers as well. But I have entrepreneurs, cancer survivors, pro football player, you know, professional athletes, world champion, Ironman, that kind of thing. and just get into their origin story and kind of get into sometimes the nitty gritty of what they do. It's been one of the best things. I've told Josh this. It's one of the best things that I decided to do. I think people thought I was crazy when I started it, but it has been so good for my soul. I mean, it's just like, I feel like I took all the shit that bogged me down and turned it into my platform. And I literally just yesterday got off the phone with a publisher. I had met with them and they want to do a book, 10,000 No's book, which is like my journey as an actor and then quotes from guests.
Hey, good for you.
Yeah, like it's led to so many things that I didn't anticipate. And it just feels right because it actually was born out of when we were doing Scandal. There was one season I was supposed to do a lot and it kind of just went away. And I was sitting around going crazy. And I finally just said, like, I don't want to wait for anything. I just want to create something and just started doing it. And then it's introduced me to so many amazing people. It's been really cool. So thanks for asking.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic. That's how I feel about this, except that everything that you did, Rishi did and brought me along for the ride.
We're going to put a link up to your podcast on this episode. Specifically, we're going to link to the episode that you did with Eli Addy.
I did one with Schiff too, if you want to put those.
Oh, even better. We'll put up links to your episodes with both Eli Addy and Richard Schiff.
Yeah. And Melina's been ducking me for like 2 years. So
the only reason I was dragging my feet is that I was hoping to overcome adversity before I came on. but I guess you just interview
I'll
me in the
you
midst
in like
of
5 years and we'll see if get something going.
Check in once a decade. I'll let you know when I'm ready.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for doing this. This was awesome.
Yeah, man.
And that's it for this episode. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Margaret Miller and Zach McNeese for helping us make this episode. Thanks to all of you for listening. And thanks to Matthew Del Negro for joining us. You can find Matthew Del Negro on Twitter @MatthewDelNegro. You can find us at West Wing Weekly or at thewestwingweekly.com or on Facebook, Instagram, all those places. Let us know what you thought of this episode.
Thanks as ever to PRX and Radiotopia. Radiotopia is a snazzy selection of sophisticated and cultured podcasts. You can find out more about the other podcasts at radiotopia.fm.
That was definitely the closest I've ever heard you to playing a light FM DJ.
Yeah, I was trying to ramp into something like that. And then I almost fell asleep during the pause.
You did too good of a job.
That's right. I was lulled.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.